The next case will be 071150, In Re Chatani. Mr. Springer, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Colby Springer for the appellants Masayuki Chatani, Glenn Vendetta, and the real party interest, Sony Computer Entertainment America, Incorporated. I believe I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case, Your Honors, at its core, is very simple. It's about common sense and logic. When the claims are given their plain and ordinary meaning, with proper consideration given to both grammar and context of the claims as a whole, an inherent order is apparent in the claims. That inherent order, that required order of execution, that is not disclosed in the prior art reference of record, the Cohen reference.
So the real issue here rests solely on whether or not the claims require the sequence articulated in that order, or whether or not they allow for changing the order. That's
correct.
The issue.
Correct. It is the appellant's argument that the claims do require a particular order, and that order is not only not present in Cohen, there is in fact no way that Cohen could be interpreted, at least based on the teachings of the disclosure in Cohen, there's no way that Cohen could be interpreted in any other way.
Can I just ask you why you didn't amend the claims then? I mean, if that was the dispute, if that's the whole reason we're all here, why, at least if you concede there's at least some absence of complete clarity, you just didn't add language in the application to avoid all of this?
The amendment could have been made. In hindsight being 2020, could the amendment have been made? Yes, but the fact of the matter, it was not, and we are here where we are today with the claims being as they are, the claims being in pristine form, and to a certain extent with the uncertainties that are often involved, you know, as the previous case just showed with respect to Festo, there's obviously an eagerness to avoid amending the claims in any case, if at all possible, because there's no telling what will happen subsequent with respect to Markman and patent litigation. So, in addition to the arguments advanced by the appellants concerning this required order, the director has raised the issue of waiver, which I'd like to speak to, as the appellants believe that there clearly is no waiver in this matter. The director raises the issue. I think the director oversimplifies specifically the case of In Re Watts, which the director relies on for the teaching or for the requirement that a waived issue cannot be raised on appeal.
What's the waiver issue here? Can you just articulate briefly what the waiver is? What aspect of the argument is dealing with?
The appellant's interpretation of what the director argues is that this issue, that there be a required order of the claims, was not raised during prosecution before the Board of Patent Appeals. Now, admittedly, the two cases that the appellant relies on heavily, the Interactive Gift Express and the Alteris versus Symantec decisions, those were not raised before the Board of Patent Appeals and Interferences. That said, that does not necessarily equate to the issue having been waived. In Re Watts, a more careful reading of In Re Watts, in fact, teaches that while a new issue may not be raised on appeal, a clarification or reinforcement of issues raised below can be appropriately addressed on appeal. That's found in footnote 3. Looking back to the appellate record, if you look specifically at the appellant's reply brief on pages 5, 6, and 7, which correspond to the record at 134 through 136, numerous discussions with respect to the requirement as set forth in Vertigal Brothers concerning the requirement that a prior art reference teach each and every limitation as set forth in the claim. So there must be not only a teaching of all the elements, but as set forth in the claim. As set forth in the claim, in this case, would encompass that required order of execution. Additional cases, and including the Manual of Patent Examining Procedure at 2131, were addressed by the appellant before the Board of Patent Appeals and Interferences. Those cases include the Richardson v. Suzuki and the In Re Bond case, which required the prior art to teach the identical invention and for it to completely disclose the same. And In Re Bond specifically requires the elements of the claim to be disclosed in the exact same manner. While Interactive Gift Express and the Alteris v. Symantec decision, again, were not mentioned by name, the substance of that argument, the claims having to have a required order of steps, not to mention the factual basis for that argument, were addressed numerous times during prosecution and for the board. It's for that regard that the appellant contends there is no issue of waiver here.
So getting on to that issue, to the issue itself, you rely on some language in the spec. I actually may have been misreading it. It seems to me there's something in the spec that says in the next operation. I don't know that you cited it, or maybe I'm misciting it.
The The argument raised by the appellant with respect to the substantive issue of the required order is that the claims on their face define everything. The plain and ordinary meaning, and taking into context, again, proper grammar and as well as contextual import, the claims say what they say. In this case, there's basically two elements that are really at issue. That's the step of determining that there has been a participant, for example, a node in a computer network, determining that a participant has disconnected from the online session. Has disconnected means exactly what it says. Has disconnected. It's past tense. It's done. It's affirmative. There's a disconnection. It's not planning to disconnect. It's not intending to disconnect. It is disconnected. It's done. Elvis has left the building. The next step from that is a broadcast by remaining participants in the system, or I'm sorry, in the session, saying, hey, participant A has left the session. We need to make some sort of adjustment. So broadcasting a notification in the Chitani, the appellant's application, broadcasting a notification that there has been a disconnection, again, affirmatively requires that disconnection to take place. So in effect, the appellant's claims require that there, A, to be an affirmative disconnection, B, for there be a determination that the disconnection has taken place.
But the prior art is referring to the remaining clients. And so they're remaining after what?
The remaining clients in the Cohen
after
reference.
After what has happened, yeah.
After there's been a disconnection.
Ah, so there's been a disconnection first, and then they're the remaining clients. They're left.
There are remaining clients, but that's not what is claimed. Again, what is claimed in the appellant's application is disconnection, determination of disconnection, and then a broadcast concerning that disconnection. Cohen, while it's admittedly in the same space, maintaining network connectivity, continuity, it goes about it in a very different way. Cohen goes about it in what the brief refers to as sort of an orderly departure.
Now, I guess I'm having trouble following you because this all goes to the heart of the question, which is whether or not this order is required, right?
Yes.
How does that inform whether this order is required? You're saying that detecting has to go before broadcasting. There's something inherent in the claim language that requires that?
Yes.
And that is?
The fact the language has disconnected. If you look at the broadcast...
Well, okay, maybe that's what I'm missing. There's several places where has disconnected appears.
So if
are you dealing with detecting or are you dealing with the broadcasting?
So if you look in the broadcast step right. Of the appellant's application, broadcasting a notification that the participant has disconnected, you can't broadcast notification concerning that disconnection until the disconnection has in fact occurred. And in between that disconnection and the broadcast is the determination of the disconnection. This is where it comes down to the claim on its face, has disconnected. There must be an affirmative, completed act of disconnection before there can be a determination of that disconnection, and then a broadcast by another participant saying, hey guys, this participant's no longer here. He has disconnected. He's no longer a part of the session.
But if you look at the Cohn reference, mm-hmm. That seems to suggest that it's the participant, the first host, they call him exiting. So on his way out the door, he sends the notification, and by the time the notification is received by the other participants, he's gone. So by the time they receive the broadcasting, he's already exited.
But this
right?
go-
And that's has disconnected. Why wouldn't that fall within the broadcasting step?
I would disagree. It does come down to an issue of semantics, but the semantics, you know, in patent litigation and claim construction of all areas of the law, semantics are probably this one of these areas where those semantics matter most. In the Cohen reference, as you referenced, there's only one entity making that broadcast. It is the entity that is leaving the session.
Right.
And this is why I was referring to earlier as the orderly departure notification. This node or this participant in Cohen makes a determination based on whatever grounds that it's going to leave that session. Before it does so, it sends out a broadcast to all the other participants saying, hey guys, I'm about to take off. Anything that I'm responsible for, now would be a good time to reassign those responsibilities. The other participants, they receive that notification, the responsibilities are reassigned, the entity leaves the session. You can't broadcast the fact that you have disconnected, has disconnected. You cannot broadcast a notification that you have disconnected if you've already disconnected.
You can't? You're saying that once the disconnection has occurred, the host disconnection package can't be received by the remaining clients?
Could it be received? Yes.
It can be.
It is, or it could be, yes. But that's not what is claimed. What is claimed in the appellant's application is determining that there has been a disconnection, an affirmative disconnection, followed by a broadcast that entity has disconnected. Looking back to the Cohen reference, and this is where the logic comes in, is you cannot make a broadcast to a session that you're no longer a part of. If I was to leave the room and make an announcement in the hallway, I'd be making an announcement to the hallway, but I would not be making an announcement to the courtroom.
No, but I thought you said a moment ago that it is possible for the information to be delivered to the remaining clients after the host has already departed.
It's possible for that packet to be sent and received, but sending that packet and receiving that packet are distinctly different than an affirmative broadcast by remaining participants in the session stating that participant has disconnected. What you're arguing
here... It's the same information, though, isn't it?
It arguably is the same information, but the hypothetical you offer is very different than what was presented by the examiner and the director during prosecution. If this was an argument the examiner wished to make during prosecution, then there may have been an inherency type of argument or perhaps even a 103 type argument. Those arguments were not made. What was made instead was a pure 102E rejection based on the Cohen reference.
And under the Cohen patent, what happens if someone steps on the plug of the host computer and no one notices it? The man is cleaning the floor.
This is an excellent question.
What happens?
And this is one of the distinctions we raised with respect to Cohen's orderly departure and Chitani's unexpected departure. So in your scenario that you offered, and which is also addressed in the appellant's opening brief, is what happens if someone does step on that plug? If you look to column 11, line 61 of the Cohen reference, which is on page 15 of the record, if that notification is not sent in Cohen and subsequently received, the other participants continue processing blindly. That may last for a few seconds, depending on the way the network has been configured and the way responsibilities have been assigned. That may allow the network to continue operating. More likely than not, however, the network will eventually collapse in on itself and fail because this entity, which has been assigned some particular responsibility to maintain the network, has left it. No one else will know about it.
Has left it without sending
a notification.
Information saying goodbye.
Goodbye, correct. So that functionality will be lost.
Can a machine be set up so that the instant it suddenly is disconnected without any shutdown procedures, it just automatically sends a goodbye message so people know you're checked out?
Could it be set up such that a message is sent?
Yes.
Arguably, that hypothetical could take place, but again, that's not what is disclosed in the Cohen reference, nor is there any suggestion, one skilled in the art, anything of that matter. Nothing was raised in that regard with respect to prosecution during examination or before the Board of Patent Appeals. So is your hypothetical possible? Yes. Was it disclosed or argued during prosecution? No.
All right. Well, let's hear from the solicitor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, as Mr. Colby has pointed out, there is a real invention here. The invention does guard against unexpected departures. That invention, however, is not claimed in Claim 1. Claim 1 broadly reads on the prior art Cohen. And I just want to clarify one of the points that Mr. Colby just made. In the third step, the broadcasting step in the Claim 1, there's a thereby clause. It's broadcasting a notification to existing participants of the online session over the communication network, thereby notifying the existing participants that the first participant has disconnected from the online session. In other words, even though the first participant is in the process of disconnecting when that message goes out, that message notifies the other parties when they receive it that the first participant has disconnected.
So you're relying entirely on the fact that there's some temporal, that there's some time frame between the time the host sends the message and the time it's received.
We certainly are entitled to rely on that fact based on the Cohen reference, based on the way it describes the exiting process, then the receipt in Claim 10 again on A17 and 18.
Cohen reference uses words like exiting and departing.
Yes.
And the provision you just cited in the claim at issue says has disconnected. Right. And there's kind of a difference between the two. Right?
Well, as Judge Jacobs pointed out, the Claim 10 also refers to the remaining participants receiving the message that was sent by the host, which implies that the host has exited already. And I'm looking at Claim 10 on A17, column 15, about line 6 here. As the application session continues receiving the remaining clients, the host changed
the remaining
back.
Clients only get this if it was sent. And it could only be sent if the disconnection was intentional or anticipated or unavoidable but foreseen. What if, in the example that I gave your adversary, what if the person who is cleaning the floor accidentally steps on the plug. Nobody knows it for an hour. And what kind of a message is sent under the Cohen patent?
I agree with Mr. Colby. A message apparently would not be sent. There's a disconnection there.
Okay.
And that is why...
But wouldn't that be a useful thing for the remaining participants to know?
That's why I started off saying Mr. Colby's client has made a very useful invention. They've got the idea that you should send continuously a message, and when that message is
Who should send the
host client
message?
Is repeatedly sending a message.
Over and over again.
And then when that message is not received,
yes.
That constitutes a detection of disconnection by the host. So that's a good invention. The claim is not limited to that invention.
And that's all predicated on the fact that there's no required sequence of the steps. The government would agree. In other words, the government would agree that if this were a necessary sequence, it's fine.
I think that's fair to say. Yes, and I can turn to that as well. I'll turn to it right now. I think there's nothing in the grammar or the logic of this claim that requires it to be in that
situation. If the claim is limited to a situation in which the host has disconnected, just gone. It's already gone. Then you have a sequence involved in that. I mean, your adversary says grammar matters.
Well, no, we're saying it's detecting that the host is disconnected. And in this particular case, as the board found, as the examiner found, in the context of Cohen, when you receive that message sent by the host as he is exiting, you are detecting that the host has disconnected.
But that means that you could receive that message after the host has already disconnected.
That's absolutely correct. That could well happen. It can happen. Well, the host disconnection process occurs locally. It presumably occurs immediately after the message is sent. The remote clients are presumably at other locations across the world. The speed of the signal travels at the speed of light. There's some processing time involved. That detection may well take place after the remaining participants have become the, quote, remaining participants, as Claim 10 says they are when they receive that message.
So you can receive the remaining other participants, not the host. Can receive a packet of information sent by the host computer even after the host computer has already disconnected.
I think that's an absolutely fair characterization.
That's not a characterization. That's a statement of fact that either is so or not.
It's a statement of fact based on the Cohen reference. The Cohen reference, when it refers to remaining participants receiving that message.
Well, Cohen, it may posit that, but is it possible for that to happen?
Well, as I just explained, it's certainly physically possible. It takes a certain amount of time for a message to travel over a network from one computer to the next computer. And during that time, the disconnection, which occurs locally, could well have occurred. And I think that's, as a matter of fact, what Cohen is telling us happens. I can go one step further if it's additional.
But surely what the Cohen patent has... is conceiving is that a host computer, before shutting down, is going to send a packet of information to everybody else saying, pick another host because I'm checking out.
By the time you receive this, I'm gone.
It doesn't really contemplate that you're going to send this, and in the very split second that you send it, you're going to pull the plug.
Well, the host computer has absolutely nothing else to do at that point. There's nothing in Cohen that suggests that the host is still there. In fact, the flow charts, figure 2D, for example, on page A7, says immediately after the host change packet is received, the next thing that's done is the host duties are transferred. So the original host is gone. And take that further step of reassigning the host duties as being the detection that the host has disconnected. When the remaining computers see the host reassignment occurring within their own processors, that is also further evidence that they have detected, that they are detecting that the first host has disconnected. There are examples one could spin out, the Elvis leaving the building example isn't bad. I see Elvis leaving the building. Yes, I'm seeing that, but an instant later I recognize that he has left the building. It's if we limit ourselves to the instantaneous point in time where the message is being sent, then yeah, there's disconnecting, but a second later detected disconnected, and that's
but that second can be all in all, because the question is whether there's time to send this packet of information. And if somebody steps on the plug, there's no time to send anything. It has no juice. No, it's gone. It has departed.
No, you're right. And if they limit the claims in that particular way to guard against the unexpected departure, then there may be something that would withstand a rejection over the Cohen reference. But that's not done here. Here we have a message broadcast, and that message is received, which is a detection of the disconnection of the individual who broadcast the message. Let me, as Judge Prost has pointed out, this does come down to the sequence of steps in claim one, and there is nothing in the grammar or logic of them that requires the detecting step to occur before the broadcasting step. The broadcasting step is a self-contained step, simply relating to broadcasting a notification to existing participants, thereby notifying them that this disconnection has occurred by the time they receive it. Again, we're before the PTO here. We apply the broadest reasonable interpretation standard. The baseline rule when we're talking about a sequence, when we're talking about a method claim like this, is that the claim steps do not necessarily have to occur in sequence unless there's something expressed in the claims that indicate that they do occur in sequence. And here, there's at best an ambiguity. Under the broadest reasonable interpretation, these claims need not occur in sequence.
But does your argument depend, I mean, even on a fair or reasonable ruling reading of the claim language, it still depends on reading the term has disconnected to mean is disconnecting, right?
I think that's fair. Detection of is disconnecting is the same as detection of has disconnected. That is correct under that reading. But perhaps more importantly, I do want to turn to the waiver argument. As we pointed out in our brief, it was clear to the board that Mr. Tritani thought his steps occurred in that particular sequence. But the problem is the board is operating against the baseline that says a method claim, the steps of method claim do not necessarily occur in that sequence. And that's what the board's holding reflected when it found the broadcasting step could be made by the departing host, and therefore that the steps did not have to occur in that sequence. It was up to Mr. Tritani, either at that time or before that time, to raise these two cases, Altiris and Interactive Gift Exchange, both of which certainly held that the steps do not have to occur in sequence, and explain how, under the tests presented by those cases, his claim nevertheless did occur in sequence. And that's a simple matter of administrative law, allowing the administrative body the chance to address the argument in the first instance. Here we've got a legal theory, but it's an expansion of the original legal theory. The original legal theory only appears in sentences, which indicates what he believes the claim holds, and the citations to the anticipation cases don't ever specifically talk about claim order or anything like that. He had an obligation before the board to raise these two cases, and I just this morning I noticed there's a fairly recent case, the Boston Scientific case, decided in August 2007, which goes over this principle once again, as do the cases starting with the Supreme Court L.A. Tucker case cited in our brief. But it says a party may not, however, advance new legal theories at the trial court level, read the appellate level. In this case, this was an appeal for an interference which went to the district court, even if the overarching legal issue was presented below. So here's a legal theory that they're now presenting for the first time before this court, based on two cases not discussed in the lower adjudicative body, where you don't have the benefit of the PTO board's reasoning on those two cases. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Springer?
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd just like to address two issues in rebuttal, the first being, again, quickly with respect to the waiver issue and with respect to the SciMed case, which I appreciate counsel this morning bringing to my attention before arguments, so we did briefly discuss that. SciMed, I think, is an extreme example, as many of the cases that were cited with respect to the waiver argument. SciMed involved an issue of, at the board level, a stipulation concerning priority, whereas on appeal, issues concerning constructive trust and equitable assignment were raised. These were clearly two issues in two very different ballparks, two different zip codes. They're nowhere close to the issue that we're addressing here with respect to does the cited art disclose each and every element as set forth in the claim, as was discussed numerous times during prosecution and before the board. Again, footnote 3 of the N. Ray Watts case clearly supports reinforcing, rediscussing, clarifying that sort of issue as we're doing here on appeal. With respect to the claim interpretation issue, I'd just like to read briefly, with the court's permission, what the verbatim language of the claim of claim one, as may be found on A10 of the record, specifically the broadcasting step, because I think having the clear, focused language is critical. The broadcasting step says, broadcasting a notification to existing participants of the online session over the communication network, thereby notifying the existing participants that the participant has disconnected. I want to be clear in this in the sense that we've talked numerous times about possibilities or the latency issue. What if the notification is sent, you know, right now, but it's not received until later? I want to make sure that we're not inadvertently setting up a straw man, because that's not the issue here. The claim language says broadcasting a notification that the participant has disconnected. That broadcast, at the time it is broadcast, the broadcasting part of the limitation, that notification must be indicating that the participant has disconnected. So at the time of the broadcast...
Well, it says what's indicating. It doesn't verify the underlying fact that he has.
I disagree, respectfully disagree, because the claim language says has disconnected. Broadcasting a notification that the participant has disconnected. Again, that disconnection must be affirmative. It must be complete. It cannot be in the process. It cannot be intended. It cannot be planned. The claim language says, on its face, broadcasting a notification that the participant has disconnected.
You would agree that it is possible, physically, electronically, for the packet sent via the host computer under the Cohen patent to be received. Even after the host computer has disconnected.
I see I'm out of time, if I may answer your question. I completely disagree. It is possible that the notification be sent while the participant is still there, and then by the time it is received, that participant has disconnected. That's not the issue, and this is the concern I had concerning the straw man, is that in this scenario that you've described and that was raised in the director's brief, that is not a broadcast that the participant has disconnected. At the time that packet is broadcast, broadcasting a notification, that notification must concern the fact that the participant has disconnected. There must be that affirmative disconnect. So at the time that packet is sent, the disconnection must have been complete, and that is simply not taught, nor is it possible with respect to the Cohen reference. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Case is submitted.